Don't move. You're listening to Harpy Hour.
We just want to share another awesome podcast with you first.
So check these guys out and stay tuned for this week's episode of Harpy Hour.
Hey, y'all. I'm Kim.
And I'm Lark. And we host Kudzu Killers, Homicide, and Sweet Tea.
Each week, we discuss the juicy details of real-life murders that happened in the southern U.S., sometimes with inappropriate laughter, but we're always respectful.
They may be old, or they may be recent, but whatever we find that perks our interest.
We download a new episode every Tuesday and another mini episode on Friday. You can find us on all the major apps as well as a few minor ones.
But we'd love you forever if you just drop on by our host page at Spreaker.com and pick your favorite app to download and listen.
So y'all come on, sit down with us with a big glass of sweet tea and enjoy listening to us talk all things murder.
And remember, don't bury the bodies without us.
Harpy Hour may contain explicit language, as well as graphic, violent, and sexual content. Listener discretion is advised.
Just saying, and go. You're the one who goes.
I'm letting you all know.
We're on notice.
Yes.
I'm aware. And go for myself.
Welcome to Harpy Hour.
Ready, set, and go.
We're the Harpies.
I'm Tracy.
I'm Liz.
I'm Steph. Liz was late. I need it to be known.
I don't but call
Liz
you
showed
out
up late
on
to work
air
because it would
late.
Be every single time if we called Steph out.
You guys have
out.
Called me out for being late before on the air, and it needs to be noted that Liz,
Liz was a total of 5 minutes late.
I think it should also be noted in my defense that we rescheduled today to start an hour earlier, and so I was really 55 minutes early.
I believe Liz was the one that said, I can start an hour early today. First.
God, I really wish I had just like a cocktail right now while this was going down.
I end regular work at 5 p.m. I need a couple minutes to power that laptop down and turn
well,
on.
Well, then you should have said, I can start 55 minutes early.
You still wouldn't have known what that meant. You're on
also,
a
you
time.
Still would have. You would have been late then.
Like, you said 55 minutes early. I can calculate 55 minutes back from when we're supposed to do it. Don't blame me.
This is my new.
I just
favorite
need it to be
hill.
Known that this time, this one time in history, Liz was late.
I
well, you're
love
all lucky
it.
That I'm even here at all because I have hardcore FOMO that all of our DC friends are going out to trivia and I'm staying home to do Harpy Hour.
Are they going out to trivia?
Yeah, they're going out to the bar and they're doing trivia tonight.
Thank you for your service, Elizabeth.
Terrible friends.
And I am jealous.
You can join them later.
Terrible friends.
I hopefully convinced them to make their team name Wishlist Was Here.
Oh, I was about to make a next to normal reference, but neither of you would get it.
No,
really, no, only no. Our listener, Adrian, would get it. Hi, Adrian.
Oh, and hey, we have another new Patreon supporter.
We
oh,
do.
Yes. Actually, I don't know. She doesn't get a shout out. That's $5, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. But I'll
fuck
shout
you,
her
Carla.
Out anyway,
yeah. Fuck you, Carla. Do better.
My high school friend Carla is donating to us because she has been a longtime fan. I would say since 2002, but technically, I guess since a few
hour.
Days ago.
Interestingly, she invented her own donation tier. Did you see
I
that?
Know, I did see that. Well, she started at one and then was like, never mind, that is not contributing enough. I need to contribute at a $3 a month level, which I appreciate her innovation.
I do too. Super, super awesome, Carla. But just like, you know, it's just so close to five.
You didn't really earn this shout out.
Yeah, but we like you anyway.
I don't know you. I don't know if I like you. But thank you for giving us money.
Yeah. You like her. You like her. She was at the wedding.
I didn't meet her. There's a lot of people at the wedding.
There were a lot of people at the wedding.
Fun fact, Tracy got married, you guys.
Is this the first episode we're recording, like full episode we're recording since then?
Yes. Yeah, this is our first regular episode that we've recorded since then.
Well, we've recorded a couple other things, so I kind of lost track.
Yeah, the extra content for
guys, I've been an old married lady for almost 2 weeks now, so the magic is gone.
As of this recording.
Yes, the magic is gone. I'm an old married lady now.
You know what I was thinking? And I don't know if this is true or not, but before the wedding.
The wedding.
When was the last time the three of us were together?
Harpy weekend in
Colorado.
So listeners, we've been airing this show for more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, since we established Harpy Hour.
Yeah. So this entire time that you've all been listening to us, we've never been together, the three of us in the
not
same
the
place.
Three of us.
Yeah.
We've been together separately.
In
but
pairs.
Not the three of us.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
Oh my God, that's weird.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
Oh, I don't like that.
Well, I mean, a whole
to be
pandemic
fair,
happened
there was
in
a
between.
Pandemic. To be fair, there was a global pandemic.
That started a month after we launched. So, yeah, I mean,
we would have seen each other more frequently.
Right. On the flight home from the wedding, I was editing on my laptop. And I think it was either episode 70 or 71. I don't remember. One of the early 70 episodes, I was saying like, oh, I'm excited to like get on a plane and fly again because I haven't done that in a long time. And Liz made a comment like, Steph's going to have a horrible flight home and she's going to be like, I never want to fly
shit.
Again.
I forgot that Liz said that. She cursed you. You cursed.
Yeah, she cursed me.
Oh, no.
I would argue that Steph ruined her own flight home.
I did.
Hashtag Steph ruins everything.
I 100% fucked myself over. So it's as true. Of right now, it is still the policy in Hawaii that even if you're vaccinated and you're flying from the mainland or anywhere outside of the state of Hawaii, you need to get tested for COVID within 72 hours of your flight. They made it so that between islands, you don't if you're vaccinated. I was kind of mistaken and thought that it was if you're vaccinated in Hawaii, you don't need to get tested before you fly back to Hawaii. So yeah,
if you are a resident of Hawaii and you have been fully vaccinated, you can return, was what you thought.
So I'm at the airport at JFK at the gate waiting to board. And I hear them be like, oh, don't forget to fill out like your travel form ahead of time. I was like, oh shit, I forgot to do that. So I log online and I'm like filling out the form and I upload my vaccine and or I try to, and they're like, this is not acceptable. Like this is not count. And if you don't have a test within 72 hours, you can't get one in Hawaii. Doesn't matter. You need to quarantine for 10 days. And I'm like, well, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to get on that flight. I told them I was not getting on and they put me on standby for the next day. And now I'm frantically looking for somewhere to get a COVID test. And it has to be from a specific acceptable list of carriers. It can't just be like anyone, any test. So I was like looking around, and this is Memorial Day. So I'm like, I can't find a fucking test anywhere for the same day. So I'm like, great, now I can't get a test until the next day. And then now I'm going to miss like multiple days of work over this because I'm already like having to activate sick call at work. So I feel like an asshole. And I find a test in the JFK airport that is on their list. That is a rapid test. So I go there, I get my rapid test. It's negative. I have my flight the next day. And then I upload my test results and it's like, this is not an acceptable test. I was like, what the fuck? I don't think I told you guys this part. So I was like, what the fuck? It still said the test was not acceptable. So I try calling the testing center in JFK. Now I'm back in New Jersey and no one's answering. Like I can't get anyone on the phone. So then I fly to the Newark airport in New Jersey because they also have one of these same little testing kiosks. And I see someone in person and they like contact the JFK one and get the proper result faxed to me or faxed to them and they print me a copy.
It was just like then, not the right form or something.
Yeah, it has to be on a, if it's from this specific testing site, it needs to be on a special Hawaii form or something. So they didn't give me the right form. It was so stupid. So then I ended up spending like the entire day figuring out this testing and having a panic attack. Jesus Christ.
So bottom line, Liz really fucked you over.
Yeah, Liz cursed me. That's what it comes down to. Liz cursed me.
Hashtag Steph ruins everything. Hashtag you're cursed. Hashtag yeah. Goddamn Elizabeth.
Yeah. That was my day, Memorial Day. I ended up going to my sister's afterwards and just like drinking beer and moaning and groaning about how awful my day was.
Well, thank you for your bridesmaid services.
Exactly. You really answered the call.
Lots of sacrifices were made amongst our friend group in getting home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people had trouble getting back from Erie.
So I think the root cause is Tracy's wedding.
Our one friend drove back early because they had car trouble or something. What happened to that guy's car?
That was like $1,200 in repair.
Yeah, but what happened? Some plug blew out or some shit?
So, yeah, it was something in the air conditioner.
Jeez.
Yeah, one of our friends, there like a fuse or something. It was like an electrical issue on the way up.
And then the other one.
And so then he was nervous about getting home. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then our other friend on the way home hit like a massive pothole.
Like 5 miles from home.
And that caused significant structural damage.
Our flight was also delayed, if that cheers.
Nobody cares.
Was it by 24 hours?
Well, I didn't fuck up my own flight, so no.
Hawaii is just so ridiculous right now.
Yes, I'm sure it's Hawaii's fault.
It's Hawaii's fault.
Okay.
Boo-hoo, Hawaii.
Yeah.
God. Liz.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do something today, please?
I will. I will do something.
Great.
Tonight, I will be presenting to you.
Tonight. It's 11 a.m. for me.
Night at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum.
Is that in parentheses?
Yes.
Perfect.
Could you hear them?
Yes. I could hear the parentheses.
Otherwise, it'd be like some kind of copyright issue or something.
Oh, R.I.P. Robin
Because we don't
Williams.
Do that.
That's a great
Just
film.
Use song lyrics for all of our teasers.
Every yes, I know. Single
I'm kidding.
We change words sometimes. Tell me about it.
You all didn't have any guesses?
I mean, I think it's about the museum.
Yes.
Okay.
That museum, whatever the name of that museum you just said.
Ava Gardner, her house. That's what I think it is. It's like her mansion.
Okay, well, it was Isabella Stewart Gardner.
Whatever. Her.
It's a museum about her.
This bitch and her house. It's historic. The end. I just did your segment.
Go see it wherever it is.
You will never guess.
They are not a sponsor.
Did it happen in the 1800s? Did it happen in the 1800s?
No, I will start in the 1800s, but that is not when it happens, and we'll get to it.
I'm excited for it.
Is it it? The incident?
Doo-doo-doo. It is. It's an incident.
Oh, I'm excited. I love incidents.
Okay,
tell us.
Okay, Isabella Stewart Gardner was born in New York City in 1840 to a very wealthy family. So she was very well educated, very well traveled, very well off. As an adult, she moved to Boston after she got married because that's where there her husband is.
Oh, it's a Boston story.
There we go.
Mm-hmm.
Is this museum in Boston?
Yes.
Okay.
Go figure.
So in Boston, she begins to hang out with like the intellectual crowds and artists. You know, she's really getting into the scholarly people. And so she starts collecting things, manuscripts, rare books, and then she gets into art, sculptures, tapestries, and then especially like Renaissance art.
Did you guys ever collect things as a kid?
Yes.
Not that I recall.
What did you collect?
Stupid shit. Well, I mean, things like pogs and
no. Did you
cards.
Have like a dedicated collection?
What do you mean?
Like everywhere I go, I collect magnets or whatever.
I kind of do that now. I get magnets when I travel.
I get mugs.
You do mugs. I like Starbucks mugs.
Magnets and or Christmas ornaments for where I go.
I used to do stickers and patches, but then I realized I never put those on anything.
I did what I referred to as, quote, I don't know why I sound like a creepy Victorian child, but like I collected, quote, fragile things. So
it's so precious.
Like I would collect like little fucking figurines from where we went, like an elderly grandmother. Like, who am I? I would collect these things as a small child because my aunt had a shadow box. And I wanted to have a shadow box too. So it was dumb.
Every year on my birthday, my grandmother would give us these little like I don't know, ceramic figurines. I think they were just like little angels, but it was like for that birth year, like oh, 1 year like old, 2 years, whatever.
Like the precious moment ones?
Something like that. Yeah.
See, I and know this because it's a fragile thing.
Did it from like, you know, 1 to like 18 or something like that. And same, like yeah. both me and my sister each like had a collection of these things.
Yeah.
And like we did literally nothing with them except put them in some china cabinet. And like our yeah. parents were like, you guys want these? Like your grandmother wanted to have them. Like, no, I don't. What the fuck am I going to do with them? Yeah. It's so useless.
I think all of my fragile things are like gone now.
I bought something fairly recently for my niece, like a precious moments gift yeah. for probably her first communion or something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but so then I started getting the catalogs like in the mail. And so my roommate is like going through our mailbox and I'm just getting these like catalogs for figurines. And she was like, are you going to be starting like a figurine collection?
I love
like,
it.
No.
I think you should. I think I'm still collecting fragile things because like mugs are still technically fragile.
I think you've evolved to something you've that's fragile, but also has a use.
Functional.
Yes.
Fragile, but functional.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. So she's
Tracy's tagline.
She's collecting.
Fragile but functional.
I mean, that describes both my life and my collection.
There you go.
Sanity. Fragile but functional. Okay, so she's collecting shit.
Mm-hmm. So when she's about 60-ish, her husband dies. And they had apparently planned on opening a private museum of their collection together. But he passed away before they could do that. So she mm-hmm. was like, well, I'll do it on my own. Sure. So like 6 weeks after he dies, she begins, like she buys land and begins construction for a museum.
Okay.
One of the things I love about this is that even though it was allegedly something that they were going to be doing together, she names the museum after herself. Like there's no in honor of her husband.
Nope.
It's just the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And here's all my
he's
shit.
Gone.
He just thought of it. He didn't do anything about it. So, I mean, bitch. No,
I mean,
all
I assume that a lot of his money went into the items that filled the museum.
He funded the museum. Okay. Yeah. That's reasonable.
Well, maybe there could just be like a little plaque in the front sponsored by, you know,
I mean, I was going to say, like, I don't get credit for just my ideas. Like, I have to actually do things with them. But if he funded it, then that's probably fair to name something after him.
Yeah. Cannot confirm to what degree, because she also came from a wealthy family to begin with. But sure, I feel sure. like, okay. you know, he was involved in the traveling and collecting, you know?
Yeah, it was something they did together.
But so she opens this museum in 1903. She moves into the fourth floor apartment over the galleries. And she personally arranges all of the galleries, decides where everything goes. And when it opens, it is one of the finest private art collections in America.
Okay.
And so the museum itself is, from the outside, not anything like architecturally amazing. Like, kind of just looks like a generic building amongst other downtown buildings. But inside, it was designed to resemble a Venetian palace.
Ooh.
So it's very, like, it's a small, intimate style museum. It's not the kind of art museum that's just all, like, very sterile and white with, like, bright lights and, like,
seems
marble
sounds
flooring.
Sounds ornate to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot like just going through a furnished castle almost. Like, there's
okay.
wall tapestries, there's furniture, pianos, chairs. And then there's the art. The art is hung on the wall. Sometimes it's also just like propped on tables. It's a very unique style of museum.
So it's more like immersive. It's not just like shit on the wall.
Yeah. Especially when she opened, she used to host like art collectives, like people to come and paint in sure. the museum or do performances. And it also has a courtyard in the middle. So like there's this giant lush green courtyard and all of the galleries are like a square around it. So no matter what floor you're on, every gallery you walk through has windows or openings that look down into the courtyard. And the courtyard has a glass ceiling. So it's really cool. It's smaller than the nearby like Boston Museum of Fine Arts, but it's definitely a really like interesting location. It's really fun to go to.
Have you been?
Yes, I have.
Nice.
It's right near my high school. So we actually used to have free admissions and occasionally do like little field trips there. Or we would like in my art classes, we had assignments to like go to the Isabella Stewart Gardner and like sketch something or whatever.
Hmm. Cool.
Isabella died in 1924, leaving the museum, quote, for education and enjoyment of the public forever. She stipulated that nothing in the galleries should ever be changed. So essentially, when you go now, the galleries are exactly the way she left them in, like, as she designed them in 1903 and as she left them in 1924.
Mm.
So nothing has been removed from the galleries. Nothing has been bought and added to them. Nothing has been rearranged. So she, like, insisted that the galleries and the collection stay the same.
Nice.
Okay.
I like it.
However, she'd left like an endowment to, you know, to continue to keep the museum operational. It wasn't quite enough. So the museum, you know, as I mentioned, it's not all like modern and fancy like, you know, most fine art museums are. So it has that kind of like lived in feeling. And it's also hasn't been maintained as well as it probably should have, like in terms of things like climate control, security. Mm. Like there's always something kind of in disrepair that needs to be fixed. So it's harder for them to maintain a museum of that nature. But let's get to the incident.
Oh, God, I'm so excited.
You know how I said that nothing should be removed from the museum?
Oh my God, someone stole something.
Someone moved something. It's not even stolen, it's just moved. That's what it is. Right?
You just walk in one day and the Monet is on the opposite wall.
Yeah.
Oh my like, God.
And, all hell breaks loose.
Isabella's fucking pissed. And
someone died in there and they can't move the body.
These are great guesses.
Well, that would have been added to the collection.
That'd be added to the collection. It'd be like, what's her nuts? Amy something, the cult leader I talked about who was mummified. And
oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We have a shrine now.
You know, terrifying. Amy what's her nuts.
Terrifying.
Carlson.
I hate it.
Carlson.
I just thought of Vanessa Carlton for some reason.
Nope. Not the same person.
Yeah. No, it's not. Mm-mm. Hurry up, Liz. Tell us before I start singing Vanessa Carlton.
Oh, my God.
So, please. In the early morning hours of Sunday, March 18th, 1990. So, by early, I mean like 1:30 a.m.
Okay, mm-hmm. So like nighttime.
Yes.
The dead of night.
Two men in police uniforms ring the doorbell or knock at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum.
Okay.
They stated that they were responding to a disturbance reported in the area.
Mm.
There were two guards on duty. One was at the desk at the time, and the other one was making rounds. So the guard duty at the desk allowed them through the employee entrance, like he buzzed them in, and then stepped away from the desk to speak to the officers, like what's going on.
Okay.
At which time the second guard returned from his rounds. And so now with the two guards both back at the security area, the police officers reveal that they are there to rob them.
No,
they're not really police officers.
Notice how I said two men in police uniforms. I did not say police officers.
Did not notice that you said that.
I did. I was like, she's being crafty again.
Uh-huh.
She's being misleading. I don't like it.
They handcuff the guards and lead them down into the basement and tie them up in the basement.
Okay.
Shit.
And thus begins the art heist.
No!
The thieves departed with 13 pieces. These were mostly paintings, but there were a few smaller items, like a small like wooden antique and a gold like ornament.
Okay.
We'll get back to that later. But so 13 pieces in total. And it took them 81 minutes to complete the heist.
I mean, I guess those things are fragile. You probably want to take them out one at a time.
Well, by heist standards, this is a long ass time.
I mean, everyone's tied up. Nobody's going to do anything.
Yeah, but so there has to be a lot of confidence that like no other alarms were triggered.
Right.
Well, I think they were right.
Because normally a heist is just in and out, like grab and dash.
Well, but clearly these guys they were took correct.
Their time. Yeah.
They were correct in their assumption because it lasted that long.
Yeah.
Maybe they had inside knowledge.
It's an inside job.
They removed all of the paintings from their frames, mostly by cutting them.
Oh, no.
From Don't their frames. Because these frames, these are pieces that are like two Tracys tall and a Tracy wide. Like these are large paintings.
Two Tracys by one Tracy.
And the frames probably weigh a Tracy, like these like giant gold ornate frames. So they
just cut them out. Oh, no.
Yeah. Like no time to like disassemble the frames. Like they just cut around the edges and pull.
Well, you're already taking an hour and a half. You might as well take the time to take it out of the fucking frame.
Well, I mean, that involves taking it off the wall and taking it apart and probably some tools versus cutting it. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I understand.
They're already taking a lot borderline too long.
Oh, that's a bad idea.
Maybe just don't do it at all.
Maybe just don't do a heist.
Don't do
it's
crime.
Just like it's such
that is the official Harpy Hour standpoint. That is our stance
to the art to just cut them.
Don't do crime.
Like if you're gonna take them, at least like respectfully take them whole.
Yes,
they leave the frames behind. Like they just like dump the frames in the galleries and they take the paintings from them. Some of the most notable pieces were Rembrandt's, including Christ in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, which was Rembrandt's only seascape that he ever made.
Rude.
Rembrandt's self-portrait. There was a Vermeer, a Manet, and a Degas.
Rembrandt's selfie? Oh, no.
There are a lot of estimates for the value of this haul, generally between 200 and 500 million. But that 500 million is the most often cited value. So that's $500 million of art.
Wow.
That these guys took.
That just makes me really anxious. This happened like decades ago and I'm anxious.
Literally cut
3 decades ago
from their frames. Billions of dollars or millions.
Oh, I can't do it. Okay.
As I mentioned, it took them 81 minutes. That's a very precise number. How do we know that?
They timed themselves. They had a stopwatch. There's a camera.
They timed themselves and then they reported it to us.
Self-reporting.
I could see that being like a thing to like taunt us, but
or I mean also the security guards.
Clearly this is not a mystery as to who it was.
The security guards could figure out what time they were tied up and what time they saw them leave if they had a clock.
Well, they didn't see them leave.
Viewpoint. Well, I don't
know. In fact,
that's why they're in the basement.
Yeah. The security guards were not relieved until like 8 in the morning when the next shift was coming in to the museum. So they were tied down there for like 7 hours.
So I guess they didn't have any like alarms that they tripped.
Yeah, there was an alarm at the security desk, but
it's like a panic button they have to push.
The guards had already stepped away from it to talk to the quote police officers.
Right, but that's something they have to activate themselves.
Yeah, it's not like a button that they press.
Like I feel like nowadays, like if you like get to, if you like touch a piece of art you're not supposed to, you could set off an alarm or something, right? Mm-hmm. So they didn't have anything like that, is what I meant.
Right. What they did have was, you know, not an alarm that like immediately contacted authorities, but they had motion detectors or motion sensors in like in the hallways and in between every room. So typically, if you were a guard sitting at the security desk in the security room, you would be notified if one of those sensors was triggered.
Gotcha.
But if there's nobody at the security desk because you're tied up in the basement, like there's nobody being notified.
I think
about
at this point,
activity.
They don't need the motion detectors to know that something is awry.
Yeah. I think they know.
They're aware.
But the motion detectors are super helpful because they do get recorded. So every time a motion detector goes off, the location and time stamp of that activity is recorded. And so that's how we're able to piece together a very exact time frame of the thieves' movement throughout the museum. We can map out, based on the motion detector triggers, how they moved and, you know, when they entered and exited every room and then when they exited the museum. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay.
We know what time they arrived. They were buzzed in. They escorted the guards down to the basement, and then they took the pieces from two galleries. One was the Dutch room. They first went to the Dutch room. They moved from the Dutch room to the short gallery, and then they left the museum at 2:45 a.m.
This is a late night.
You don't rob a museum at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Tracy.
People have done that or tried to.
I'm just saying. I'm not telling you the success rate is great. I'm just saying that, you know, gotta be a night owl for this industry.
The guards, as I mentioned, remained handcuffed all morning until the next shift arrived. So that was, you know, about 7 hours for these thieves to like clear their trail, take off and cover their tracks. Nobody shows up until Sunday morning. As I mentioned, the date, March 18th, this is the Sunday after St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, that's like Boston Christmas.
Yeah, this is like the busiest day of the year for law enforcement.
Oh, God.
There's obviously St. Patrick's Day itself where people are out being reckless and drinking. And so all of the authorities.
Oh, so everyone's busy.
Yeah.
Okay. Everyone's distracted. That's why.
We're in, you know, the sort of hot spots, South Boston primarily. And also, even though regardless of what day St. Patrick's Day actually falls on, Boston always has its museum on Sunday.
Yeah.
They're busy tending to drunk rowdiness all night and then preparing for the parade Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And so now they get this call about this art heist and they like don't have probably the best response that they should have had. There were officers responding and they were touching the evidence before the appropriate forensic teams and photographers were on site. It wasn't handled the best way, but almost certainly the thieves used that in their strategy. Like that was not a coincidence. Mm. You know, they picked the busiest day.
Well, yeah.
When a boxing match was going on.
Yeah. I was going to say that was literally like my segment.
So it's impossible to go through every single suspect, but we will go through some of the most prominent.
Okay.
Beginning with the guards.
Okay.
Whereas most high-end fine art museum security guards, for instance, the nearby Boston Museum of Fine Arts, their guards are like retired cops. People with trained professional backgrounds in law enforcement. They know how to tackle somebody, how to handle a gun, et cetera, et cetera. The guards at the Isabella Stewart Garner Museum were just like junior mall cops. They were literally like college dropout stoner musicians.
So question, we're just relying purely on the security guard's testimony here? Like there's no video or...
There's only video. There is no video. There's typically video of
there's no video.
Oh, okay, great.
Typically the only video at the museum is I believe the front desk security area, like the doorways. I don't think that they had video throughout the rest of the museum. They just had the sensors.
Okay, so my point is that we only have the robbers themselves to corroborate what the guards said, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. The only people that can verify what happened are the guards and the thieves.
Okay. So yeah, they would be a suspect.
There were two guards.
How'd they tie themselves up?
One is not particularly the focus of any attention.
Is he too dumb?
But there is one that is. So Rick Abbath, who was 23 years old at the time, was frequently known to show up high to the job. He was in a band.
Clutch.
And he would often be like partying with his bandmates all day, drinking, smoking. And then at like 8:30 at night, he'd be like, oh, shit, can I borrow somebody's car? I got to go to work. And then would just like go to his security job at the museum, stoned and high. It was also known that they would like bring their instruments because there's literally nothing to do.
Walls.
When it's just the two of you trapped in this museum for like 12 hours. So they would just like jam out with each other and whatever. So like these were not very like serious focused people.
Yeah. Didn't I say in the beginning it was an inside job?
You did. It's always an inside job.
I predicted it. I should be a cop.
We're going to go back to the movements throughout the museum.
Okay.
I said that there were 13 pieces that were taken.
Right.
And they were taken from two rooms, the Dutch room and the short gallery.
Mm-hmm. How many rooms are there total in the museum?
There's four floors. I don't remember exactly how many rooms there are total, but like there's this multiple.
This is a relatively small part of the museum.
Right. Yeah. So okay. These rooms were both on the same floor.
They seemed focused.
They went to the second floor, spent some time in one room, spent some time in another room, left.
They had a plan.
But there's an anomaly in there.
Oh, tell us.
Of the 13 pieces that were removed from the museum, one of them was not like the others.
Ooh.
The Manet was missing from the blue room.
Okay.
What's interesting about that is that when you read the motion detectors, nobody entered the blue room during the heist.
Aliens. Huh. It's aliens.
Huh.
Or ghosts.
The thieves ghosts. Didn't go there. The only person that entered the blue room that night was security guard Rick Abbath.
When he was doing his rounds
before the thieves arrived.
Okay.
So he walked through the museum doing his rounds. He walked through the blue room.
Uh-huh.
Returned to his desk.
With the Manet.
On the way, he opened one of the side doors to the museum, which he says he does all the time to make sure that it's locked. And if he had, that would have been against protocol, and he should have been reprimanded for it. Like, you weren't supposed to do that. You're not supposed to open the doors.
Yeah, but did he leave it open?
He did not. It's alleged that he may have used that opportunity to signal the police officers. So he opens the side door. He says he does that all the time, returns to his desk, sends the other guard on his rounds, and then that's when the officers show up to be let in. What's also interesting about the Manet is that it's the only painting that the frame was found in a separate room from where it was taken. So the thieves left the frames behind where they were taken. So they just dumped them on the floor, cut the paintings out, and left the frames there.
Mm-hmm.
The Manet was carried back to the security office. And the frame, the empty frame, was left on the chair in the security office.
Is the Manet somehow more valuable than the other ones?
Mm-mm. Like, no, the Christ on the Sea of Galilee, the Rembrandt, is the most valuable out of everything they took.
I was going to say maybe that was the actual target and they did the others like as a crime of opportunity or as distraction, but that doesn't make sense if it's not the most valuable. So never mind.
I feel like there could be other explanations for that. I mean, like if maybe that's the first one they tried and they wanted to get out of the frame and realized this is too hard, so they gave up on it and then went just cut the others out, or like, I don't know, or like they couldn't get it out, so they moved it somewhere else easier to play with it. So, I mean, there could be other explanations, but
yeah. Sure. But I think the most prominent evidence are the detectors,
the fact that
indicating that.
Without that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Know, that's incriminating.
The thieves didn't actually go to that room.
Exactly. Right.
Yes.
So perhaps he knew about this and he saw an opportunity for himself and was just like, I'm going to take this little thing. Because it was one of the smaller pieces. Like he could have just, he didn't need to remove it from the frame. He could have just like tucked it into his jacket. So maybe, you know, he thought that he would just get himself a little something that nobody would notice, or that it would blend in with all the other pieces that were stolen.
Right.
And, you know, he would not be suspected because he wasn't involved.
Well, is there a timestamp on that? We know that it was before, right?
Yes.
Okay.
There are some guards that argue that the sensors weren't all that reliable. However, experts were brought in to test the sensors and they were allegedly all working, you know, as they were supposed to. But all that being said, Rick Abbath was dismissed.
Okay.
As a suspect. He was considered too incompetent or foolish to pull anything like this off.
He's too dumb.
He was like a hippie. Like in the pictures, he has like Al Yankovich hair and he's wearing a tie-dye shirt underneath his guard shirt. And he's got like a fanny pack on. It's ridiculous.
This guy is not sophisticated enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
So he is not charged. The police or detectives turn their attention to organized crime. One of their early suspects was our friend Whitey Bulger.
Yay, our bestie.
Yeah.
Whitey Bulger.
He was known to be smuggling money and weapons over to the IRA. And it was also known that allegedly the IRA had a habit of using stolen art to buy more arms.
Mm.
And so they were thinking that maybe, you know, Whitey smuggled stuff over on one on a boat called the Valhalla. And maybe he had sent the IRA these paintings so that they could use it as like collateral or trade for more weapons to support their cause.
Okay.
Bulger denies any involvement. And in fact, he is really upset about this whole heist deal because this is his territory and he didn't know about it. So somebody else went and committed this crime without authorization. Yeah.
Now you pissed off Bulger.
Yeah. So now he has his own people on the case trying to figure out who did this because they owe him money. Like they have to pay him a tribute to commit crimes on his turf. So Whitey Bulger also dismissed.
Okay.
Instead of the Irish mafia, it's likely the Italian mafia. There are a lot of people involved in this like massive web of strings on thumbtacks connected to each other type situation. Charlie Day picture.
Gotcha. Yes. I'm picturing it.
So I try to simplify this. You know, there were two men clearly who committed the crime, but it was likely part of a larger involvement. Think Ocean's 11, you know, type situation where it was somebody's idea and they had somebody else execute it. And then they had somebody else probably move those paintings around. So there's a lot of potential suspects that were involved to some degree. But we'll focus first on Bobby Donati. He was alleged to have worked a few smaller heists in the New England area with another art thief, Miles Connor. However, we know Miles wasn't involved because he was in jail at the time.
For an art heist. Likely story.
Seems suspect.
Real nice alibi.
Unconfirmed.
But he'd said that, you know, previously he and Bobby had cased the museum before in the 80s. They had talked about and started planning stealing some things from the Gardner Museum. And so, you know, he kind of tips the authorities that it might have been, you know, his old friend, Bobby Donati.
Little snitch.
Okay. Snitches get stitches.
Donati had motivation. He likely wanted to get his boss out of jail, Vincent Ferreira, because there's some gang wars going on. It's a real tough time out there to...
It's hard out there for a pimp.
Yeah, to be in a gang, especially if you're like lower down on the ladder. And so he really wanted to get his boss out to protect him.
Pro tip, don't join a gang.
How does robbing a museum get his boss out of jail?
Well, thanks to Miles Connor, who was not involved because of his
alibi
of being in jail.
Supposed alibi.
Miles allegedly is kind of the thief who established the myth that art is a get out of jail free card. So he would just steal art and then offer the art back to authorities to reduce his sentence or be freed. And so there was this kind of unwritten rule that if you had art or something of similar value and then you were arrested for a drug deal or a murder, you could say, you know what? I might have something you want. And then you could offer that art as a trade for a lesser
bargaining chip. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bribe.
How art is a bargaining chip for like people's lives, I don't really know why that's acceptable, but that was this idea that a lot of criminals seemed to have, that, you know, you could steal art and then just hold on to it until you needed to use it for leverage. And so Bobby Donati could have planned on stealing this art and then waiting for the best opportunity to make a deal with the authorities on behalf of his boss.
It's just his rainy day fund to get out of jail.
Essentially, yeah.
Okay.
It's convoluted.
I'm not buying this.
Yeah, but this never came to fruition because...
it's ridiculous.
Aforementioned gang wars, Bobby Donati was found decapitated in the trunk of his car a year after the heist.
Womp womp.
Jinx.
Bob Donati. That's what I have in my head.
So you know? he there was another guy that might have been the second person that he would have worked with on it. He died of natural causes. So now the two suspects who committed the crime are no longer with us to investigate.
Okay.
They also didn't match witness descriptions of the police officers. So maybe they were the ones who masterminded the whole thing. It's really hard to say. But let's talk about some of Donati's other connections. He had a good friend named Robert Garante.
Okay.
Bobby Donati and Robert Garante were seen at a social club shortly before the robbery with a bag of police uniforms.
Oh. Huh. Well, there's your guy. Like, yeah. I don't understand. Why did we go through all the other people?
Yeah. It's them. They did it.
I found the criminal. There it is.
We solved it 30 years
it's
later.
It's believed Perfect. That Donati gave the paintings to Robert when he started to become concerned for his own safety. So he was just like, can you hold on to these for me? And then Robert Garante himself died from cancer.
Can you hold on? Just fucking burn it or something. What do you mean go hold on to this for me?
I might need it again for another heist. Well,
why would he burn it? It has value.
Are you talking about the police uniforms or they were handing the police uniforms?
No, sorry. I'm sorry. The art. The paintings.
Oh, okay. That's much different.
You were saying they were handing the police uniforms over. I'm like, just burn the police uniforms. Like, why are you holding... I thought you were talking about that. I'm like, that's stupid. Just get rid of it.
No, sorry. The paintings.
Okay.
So he would have given the paintings to his friend.
Okay.
To hold on to and protect for him. But, you know, so
not the
Bobby Donati
is
decapitated. And so now Robert Garante would be the one in possession of the paintings.
Right.
He dies of cancer in 2004.
Oh.
His widow later tells the FBI that her husband had previously owned some of the paintings. So she's like, I've seen it. He had them. But allegedly, when he got sick with cancer, he didn't want to hold on to them anymore. So he gave the paintings to his friend, Robert Gentile, for safekeeping.
This just sounds like they're just passing these paintings around. Like,
yeah.
Right. Is anyone displaying them, enjoying them? Like, what? Why
did
we steal
them? Like I said, we couldn't get into every suspect, but there are a lot of people who have come forward to say, I saw the Monet. I saw Rembrandt's self-portrait.
Sure.
Like, other people involved in different roles in the Italian mafia have allegedly, like, there was one woman who said that she helped her brother move into a new apartment. And he hung up this painting and she thought that it looked silly, like in his, like really out of place in his apartment. And that he had bought this, like he had bought a new gold frame for it. And she was like, she remembered thinking how ridiculous it was that he had just like a really shit apartment, but he like made an effort to gold frame this painting. And then, you know, years later, when presented with like the list of paintings that were stolen, she recognized it and she was like, oh, my brother had that painting. And there's people who say that at parties amongst this crowd, they saw one or two of the paintings. So
they just enjoyed it amongst themselves. They didn't sell it and make money off of it. They just stole it and enjoyed them for themselves.
I mean, there are other theories that the whole thing was orchestrated by like a Russian oligarch who is just holding all of the paintings in his private collection, like in his Russian mansion, or some James Bondish millionaire type person.
Right.
Just hired people and he's enjoying it in his whiskey room or something like that. Like, we don't really have any actual evidence of anything like that happening. They're just wild theories. But so nobody has seen all 13 pieces, but people have allegedly seen one or two here and there being displayed under certain circumstances. So back to Robert Gentile, he gets the paintings, allegedly claims to the FBI he knows nothing about them. He fails a polygraph test, at which point he's like, oh, yeah. My friend Robert Garante showed them to me once at a party, but I never had them. So the FBI raids his place. They find a secret ditch underneath a floor in his like shed in the backyard. It's empty. His son explains that the ditch had flooded a few years earlier and that his father was very upset about whatever was stored there. So great. Now, potentially, these million-dollar works of art are, like, flood damaged.
Womp womp.
But so when the FBI investigate, there's no paintings, but there is a piece of paper with the list of paintings.
Well, that could be anything.
And how much money they would sell for on the black market.
That doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely not.
Coincidence.
Yep. So now Garante says that he was just trying to broker their return. So this is something that, based on my research, seems to happen a lot, that, like, to kind of make the trail harder to follow, criminals broker deals or step in and help make arrangements. And so you might be involved in, like, the transport of stolen goods without ever actually seeing them, for instance. And so he was saying that he had the list because he was going to, like, help with their sale or exchange, but that, like, it never panned out and he never saw them and he never had them.
Okay.
So there are bazillions of other possible connections or, you know, people that may have been associated either with planning the heist, executing the heist, or moving the art around. But to this day, not a single one of those 13 pieces has been recovered. And not a single arrest has been made in connection with them.
This is bullshit.
Mm-hmm. And so it's very complicated to follow. In part, you know, there's the whole Monet from the Blue Room. It's kind of an outlier, as is the gold ornament that was a filial on a flagpole. And there were other pieces in the museum that they had started to remove and then abandoned. And so the collection as a whole, like, there's probably like 9 or 10 of the pieces that kind of make a collection, but there's a few outliers. And so the FBI doesn't understand, like, what the motivations are. Like, were those pieces on a list? Like, were those meant to be taken? Were they just taken out of opportunity? Did they have extra time? And so they were just running around grabbing random shit. So the collection as a whole, the 13 pieces, it's really hard for the FBI to find, like, a motivation behind the pieces that were stolen. Especially because I mentioned the Christ in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, mm-hmm. Was the most expensive or valuable painting that they stole, but it was not the most expensive painting in the museum. There still is at the Isabella Stewart Gardner, The Rape of Europa. And if you don't recognize the name, if you Google it, you would
recognize the name, but why?
The Rape of Europa was purchased for $100,000 in the late 1800s by Isabella. And so right now it would be valued at about $25 million. So that was actually the most expensive piece in the museum, but they didn't go for it.
So these were, like, targeted pieces then. It wasn't about the money.
Or it might have just been about efficiency, because the Rape of Europa was...
I was going to say, maybe it was like the most bang for your buck, like,
yeah,
get the things that are close together that are worth the most instead of zigzagging across the entire 4 floors of museum to get the best.
Exactly. Yeah, it could have just been a matter of efficiency. But so that's, you know, nobody knows. We haven't really gotten to the bottom of what the motives were. You know, why they went for the pieces they went for, what they wanted to do with them, or anything like that. So the FBI alleges in 2013, with a high degree of confidence, that they know who stole the paintings, but those people are dead.
Oh, that's anticlimactic.
Yeah. I pretty much just described a whole bunch of people in the Italian mafia who are no longer with us. So nobody has been charged with the crimes, but very likely all of those folks were related in one way or another. The one who is still alive is Robert Garante. He is still alive. He continues to deny any involvement, and the police do not have enough evidence to press any charges. If they could, they would. But, you know, some people believe that maybe when he dies, the paintings will appear.
I doubt it.
It would really suck if literally nobody ever sees these pieces ever again.
I would feel like he would probably, if he has them, pass them on to someone else.
Well, I think there's kind of this idea that at some point it's going to be passed on to somebody who's not going to want to keep them, or somebody who will actually offer them up to police in exchange for something. Gotcha. Like at this point, like if Robert thinks he's going to die and he passes the paintings on to somebody else for safekeeping, like what are you keeping it for? What are you going to do with it?
Yeah, because they're so famous, you can't like sell them because people will be like, oh,
this is that missing
fucking
painting.
Monet, you know, like,
well, on the black market you could. But so it's kind of believed that at some point, maybe like when the right person dies, this collection will materialize because there won't be as much of a personal concern in safekeeping them.
Gotcha.
But, you know, we don't know where it is. And so the FBI's focus right now is not on the who, but the where. And, you know, they just want to track the paintings or the pieces and get them back. The museum, to wrap things up, is offering a $10 million reward for the return of these paintings. Nobody has come forward to claim it yet. But if you go now to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, all of the frames have been returned to their original placement. So they're just giant empty frames, and they were on the wall.
So sad.
Yeah.
They stay there as symbols of hope awaiting the return of their art. So when you go, it's kind of there's like an eeriness to it.
Oh, that's so creepy.
It's a really cool museum, but then you also walk through these galleries that just have giant gaping holes on the wall.
That makes me sad.
Surrounded by a gold frame. Oh. And so it serves as a reminder, you know, that those pieces are still out there and are waiting to come home.
Now I'm depressed.
Oh.
God damn it. God damn it, Elizabeth.
So keep your eye out. Everybody Google Christ in the Storm on the Sea of Galilee and keep your eye out for it. You never know.
You could win $10 million.
Got it. I'm on it. You know, if three white women with a podcast can't solve this crime, I don't know who can.
It's unsolvable at that point.
So
none of which are in Boston.
It's true. I think we're perfectly suited for this.
It's very unlikely that the work is still in Boston.
I think it's less likely that they're in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I'm no expert.
Maybe it's hidden in the mountain. Maybe it's hidden on 14ers because people were not meant to climb 14ers.
Yes, that would be a really good, like, they buried stole in a bunch a mountain of art vault. And then hid them on mountains.
Yep. That makes
it's the perfect crime.
That's what I would do.
Why? No, you wouldn't.
I mean, I would pay someone to, like, Sherpa it up there.
If I hiked, I would do that.
Yeah.
You would absolutely not do that.
Yeah, probably not. I'd be a terrible criminal to begin with.
Jesus Christ.
I was trying to think of a smart segue. It's not coming to me, guys.
I thought you were just like pausing. I'm like, it's still you. You did the do.
No, I know it's me.
Okay.
I know it's me. If you want to hear updates on the not Ava, but Isabella blank Gardner Stewart Gardner Museum.
Updates on our investigation into this crime.
You can listen to Harpy Hour on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. Wherever you listen, please rate us and leave us a glowing review, hopefully with the name of the criminal that robbed the museum.
Yeah, and if you do know or you've seen any of these paintings,
if you see something, say something.
The real originals. I know there's lots of reproductions. Don't be fooled.
Be vigilant.
Tell us what you know.
Yes, tell us, not the FBI. Tell us.
Email us at harpyhourpodcast@gmail.com. And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Harpy Hour Pod. Just tag us and the FBI.
On like the FBI's Twitter account. Jeez.
And if you stole these paintings and now have an assload of money, give us some of it.
We don't need to know where it came from.
We don't need to know where it came from.
A bunch of times on this show.
But just saying, if you did that and you have the money and you're listening and you are fans, you should donate on Patreon to help keep us on the air.
You definitely should.
Again, don't tell us that's how you have the money. We probably will not keep your secret for legal purposes. Just give us the money. Thanks for listening.
Okay,
bye.